UN scientists say they found a 34% jump in what are called ocean dead zones in the past 2 years. Those are areas where water pollution is so bad that marine life has trouble existing. The UN says there are at least 200 dead zones in oceans across the planet. The ozone layer above Antarctica is now larger than ever before, larger than the size of North America. Scientists say human-manufactured gases are to blame. And Mexico has lifted its ban on California lettuce, a ban that had been put in place after the E. coli outbreak in August. China's biggest bank has raised $19 billion in the world's biggest IPO, a much larger response than expected, with more than a million Hong Kong residents placing orders. Goodwill is celebrating the donation of a watercolor painting that turned out to be extremely valuable. They just sold it at auction for $165,000, say they have no idea whether the anonymous donor knew its value before dropping it off. Merck Pharmaceutical is reporting a 34% drop in its third quarter income, and GM's third quarter sales are down 3% from a year ago, though it did improve its U.S. market share during the quarter by 1%. OPEC announcing today it's decided to cut production by 1.2 million barrels a day. That's more than previously announced. Nonetheless, oil prices are falling. They're down $1.10 this hour, $57.40 a barrel. Gold trading at $597 an ounce, and on the Wall Street, the Dow is down 18 points at 11,993. Both the NASDAQ and S&P 500 are flat. More at QualityNewsNetwork.com. I'm Diana Walter. It's now 5 past the hour.
They counted the votes in a web of deception. The GOP stole the election. Good afternoon, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. That, of course, is the special election music. I'm getting excited about the election. It's occurring, folks, in just 2 weeks. Can you believe it? In 2 weeks and a few more days, we can actually kick out the Republicans. And so that's why I had the special theme music. Every Friday, we're going to have the Inside Scoop live to celebrate, hopefully, the kicking out of the Republicans. And every Friday, we'll have that special election music. I've got three interviews today. One I talked about on yesterday. They're interviews I conducted a few months ago, but they are very much part of the discussion in the election today. The first is Clint Curtis. Now, you heard a lot about the election machines that could steal the vote yesterday. Well, Clint Curtis, well, you'll hear his story. Let's go right to the interview.
Sitting in front of me right now in the flesh is Clint Curtis, one of my favorite guests, and I know one of your favorite guests on the show. Clint Curtis, of course, is famous for being the one who busted the Republican plan to manipulate the vote in Florida technologically. A lot of you I know are concerned about electronic voting without paper trails. Well, Clint Curtis is who's giving us the smoking gun, if you will, regarding that. He's been on my show a number of times. We're always glad to have him back, particularly in person. Clint Curtis, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Thank you for having me.
And now I understand you are running for Congress against the very man who originally ordered you to manipulate the votes in Florida, Tom Feeney.
Correct.
Okay.
We're going to take it to him in his own hometown.
So now how did you come to this decision to actually go forward from someone who had been a technology analyst, former Republican, to actually taking on the man himself?
Well, we put it all out there. We did the testimony before Congress. We did the polygraph test. You know, we put it out, and a lot of people are not addressing the issue. They're still trying, and that's on both sides, you know. All across the media, Democrats include alarm going, well, people aren't going to come out to vote if we tell them that their vote won't count. So we're going to bring them out and let them find out on their own again, you know. And
well, let me go through your story, because some of my listeners know it well. For some, you're a brand new name. Tell us exactly what happened in Florida in 2004.
It's actually in 2000 that I worked Oviedo, Florida,
right,
for a company named Yang Enterprises. And at the time I was working there, there was Tom Feeney was working there. He was the incoming Speaker of the House,
Speaker of the House of the state of Florida.
Speaker of the House of the state of Florida. Corporate attorney, and our head lobbyist. Very, very cozy.
Very cozy.
You know? And he was well-connected. He was the running mate for Jeb Bush. and he was the elector for George both times. So he was very Bush connected, and his job was basically to come in and feed us contracts. He would come in and say, the legislature, or I'm thinking about proposing this, can you guys do it? If you can, I'll tell you how to get the contract, you know. I guess that's the way politics works. I don't know.
Well, it certainly does
in
Florida.
Yes, that's what works in Florida, definitely. So he came in, and this was very early on. I didn't know, you know, that he was a crook or anything then.
And you were just a computer guy, right?
Computer programmer.
Okay.
He would bounce things off and say, could we do it? And I'd say, yes, we can do it. No, we can't do it. Depends on how they want it. So he came in, and he wanted a program that would be able to basically rig elections.
Now, how does this program work? It's sort of a touch screen type thing where you touch it a certain way and you get a certain vote you want. How does it work specifically?
Right. Well, it will actually go on any computer. It will go on touch screens. It will go on scanners. It will go on anything that calculates the vote. Very simple to do. But what he specifically requested was he wanted three things. He wanted it to be touch screen capable, so it would work on a touch screen machine. He wanted it so that you didn't have to have any third-party implements. You didn't have to insert anything in the machine. You didn't have to have any keyboards or
No security cards necessary.
Nothing to hack from the external view. And he wants so that the source code, you'd be able to see the source code, but not be able to see where the manipulation occurred, which, of course, you can't do because source code is the human-readable part of the code.
Yeah, but I thought source code, you can actually get it to sort of eat itself so that after you've done something, it can sort of hide the tracks.
You can get the executables to eat themselves, but the source code is actually what the human looks at before they compile it.
I see.
So told him he couldn't do that, okay. And the owner of the company stepped in and said, we'll write it for you anyway. You can show it to the people you need to show it to, because he was always showing our stuff to people. And so the next day I wrote it up, because it's very simple to do, and gave him the rules of how you would find vote fraud. In other words, make sure you have source code available, because you can see it.
So in other words, you were doing this as a way to show them how you could discover a cheating voting system.
Correct, because the Democrats were in power at the time, and he was a Republican, and I was a Republican, and the company was a Republican, and so, you know.
So, in other words, he came to you saying, how could you develop a program to detect voter fraud?
Well, he didn't actually say that. He just said he needed a program that would do voter fraud.
Okay.
And
you assumed he how you could detect.
Right. I thought he was coming from, you know, you give people the benefit of the doubt until they prove you wrong.
I see.
So I handed in, you need to print out, make sure it prints out a paper and audit the paper against the actual machine, and make sure it doesn't connect to the machine anyway. Can't have any physical connection. That paper needs to be removed, so you can't have a printer hooked to the side or anything strange like that. And so I said, here you go. And she says, well, you don't understand. This isn't for stopping vote fraud, you moron. This is basically, you know, for flipping the vote in South Florida.
And she said something about the black vote. What were the words?
Well, later on, sitting in on other conversations with Feeney, he didn't say it at the same time. He was talking about suppressing the black vote.
Suppressing the black vote.
By having his, which he was claimed as his, exclusionary list.
What does that mean? Exclusionary list.
Down in Florida, they had these felon purge lists that they came up with. I didn't know about the time when he was talking about it, but that's what they were. And anybody with a similar name couldn't vote. So it didn't make any difference if you were a felon or if you just happened to be committing the terrible crime of being black and voting at the same time. If your name was close, they wouldn't let you vote.
So what happened with this program that you developed for them? I mean, you showed them, I guess, how to commit voter fraud. Not that you intended to do that,
right.
But you thought you were trying to help prevent it. And meanwhile, you give them this program. What did he do with it?
Don't know. But all the laws are now written so that basically the opposite of what I told them to use in order to stop vote fraud. So basically, I gave them the blueprint. More than the prototype, I also gave them the blueprint. So
give me an example of what some of the laws are that are the opposite of what we need to prevent voter fraud.
Well, one of the things you need is you need source code that you can examine.
Open source code where anyone can see what's going on.
Now, that has other qualifications because you also have to be able to compile it. You have to have the environment so that you can make the executable and make sure it goes on the machine. Because if I put something on a machine and then I give you the source code for it, you can't tell if it's the same thing unless you actually do the
calculation. Right, you have to see actually what's in the machine. I mean,
Correct.
Anyone can write anything on a piece of paper.
Exactly.
You have to make sure that actually it's in the machine.
Right.
So I know that Diebold, which makes more than half of the voting machines in this country, Diebold, Sequoia, ES&S, I guess, or 90% of it, refuses to allow their source code source code to be reviewed. They say this is a part of our trademark process. How to add one plus one to a vote count apparently for them is so complex that they don't want to let anyone learn the source code.
Yes, but it's all proprietary for some reason.
But the state of Florida protects Diebold in doing this?
Oh, yes.
How do they do that? Is there a law that says that?
Yes, they protect their property rights, and they, in fact, they recently are trying to pass a law. This is how out of hand it's got. But there was a fellow down there named Ion Sancho, and he actually...
He's been on my show a number of times. He's a terrific guest.
He actually did a test to say, okay, let's see if they're right. Let's see if these people are crazy or whatever. Let's test it. So he tested it on his own and found out, of course, that, you know, it's broken, it's easy to hack, it's a mess. So now the state of Florida is attempting to pass a law that says that the supervisor of elections cannot test their machines without approval
from the company,
the Secretary of State,
the
companies,
and
if they do want to test it, they have to come from the approved list provided by the Secretary of State.
That's amazing. That's amazing. That's like saying that you can't ever investigate anything.
You can't investigate anything.
It's like saying we're going to have a health inspection, but only by telling you the day before the health inspection exactly where we're going to go, what we're going to test.
And you have to use our health inspector.
So now, is this Florida law, or is it sort of the Secretary of State?
It's something they're working on right now to get enacted. Previous to that, they snuck in a little thing because there's a matter of another step you need to do is you need to do an audit. So when you have the paper that's printed from this machine that should be separate, you then audit it against the machine. So you go, okay, this machine, lockdown machine number 22, how many votes does Fred have? How many votes does Sally have? Let's look at the machine. Does it match? Real simple stuff. Well, not only do they not give you the paper, and in fact didn't even certify anything that allows you to have the paper, a lot of Democrats last year were pushing, well, let's vote by absentee ballots.
Right, because they said at least that we'd have a paper record.
We have paper record. It's great, right? And then we'll just force them to count the paper record.
Right.
Florida law was changed so that once you take that paper and you run it through the scanner, you cannot verify the count.
What happens to the paper?
It's like it disappeared.
They just put it aside. We can't ever look at it again.
You can't look at it. You cannot audit the machine.
Because then you could find out that you had 100 votes for X and 50 votes for Y. If the machine counted, 102 votes for Y, you would know the machine's fraudulent.
Exactly.
So it's all about ways to protect the fraudulent machines.
Exactly.
Now tell me this. You know this. I know this, mostly from talking to people like you and Ian Sancho. Why isn't this front page news at Tallahassee and Orlando and Miami and Fort Lauderdale newspapers?
I don't know.
Yeah, see, I have trouble with that one, too. I thought you might have some answers for me. So now, are you...
Well, a lot of people are... it calls a lot into question. We are in a war with... it's a made-up war, but we're in it. And people are dying. And if you call this into question, you now have a legitimacy problem with the entire government.
But see, Clint, here's the question I have. You are running for Congress.
Yes.
Against Tom Feeney.
Right.
In a precincts, I presume, that use the very voting machines that you believe are hackable if not hacked.
Correct.
Is that not a quixotic quest? Is that not like Don Quixote going after windmills? You are saying that the system is broken, that no amount of votes can fix it because they can manipulate it. Vote for me.
Right. And
people must laugh at that.
It takes a geek to break a geek.
Okay.
He who hacks last hacks best.
Okay.
So what we have going here, and in fact, I'm hoping they'll flip it. I'll be really disappointed if they don't.
Interesting. So, and then you could actually prove it and
right.
go after them.
I have a parallel system set up so people will be able to vote online for me. And people will be able to go in themselves, or I also have volunteers who will be collecting votes. And so I'll know precinct by precinct how many votes I need to have. Now, I don't need...
Well, but, voting online for you. If I'm a supporter of Tom Feeney, and there must be three people, and maybe his mother and a couple others that still support this guy, I'm not going to vote on your website. So you could say,
It doesn't matter.
Why not?
I don't need his votes.
Oh, just to count your votes, you mean?
All I'm counting is my votes. So I'm not saying, I beat Tom Feeney by 32%. I'm saying, in precinct two, 100 people that live in precinct 2 said they voted for me.
And only 73 were counted, so there's
right.
a problem there.
Right.
Now, well, why can't they just do it the other way? They can just increase Tom Feeney's votes and say, if 100,000 people vote for you, we'll just make 120,000 vote for Tom Feeney.
I don't see Tom Feeney's votes. I only see my votes.
Right. No, I'm just saying, in order to defeat your idea of saying that they hacked the election, instead of decreasing your votes, they could hack it by increasing Feeney's votes. And then how do you prove it?
Well, then your totals are off. Now, you could do that, and in Florida that can happen because they had machines that recorded 4,000 votes when there were only 400 people that could vote.
I see.
And that could happen. But
then
most,
you could say only 400 people voted because we only have 400 signatures in the book, and that's something you can prove.
Most of these gutless politicians will simply give up. They'll say, oh, well, I concede. I'm not going to fight it. And that's not going to get you anywhere. You know, these people want to win. They will do anything to do so. If we're going to take this country back, we have to be ready to fight them. So I will not concede.
Now, one of the things that
happens, I want every vote counted before it goes on the record.
Well, Al Gore, of course, the famous election in 2000, and he fought pretty long before he conceded, and I don't know if he really conceded, or if the
Supreme Court conceded for him.
That's frankly how I began on radio. That's a whole other story. But it seemed to me that I had a decent amount of respect for the Florida courts. Yes, some were better than others, but at least they seemed to be trying to get to the heart of the problem. But the legislature, led by Tom Feeney, was working around the courts to say, we don't care what the courts say. We don't care what the people say. We're going to overrule them and do our own thing. Isn't there a fear that the legislature, controlled by Tom Feeney and others, by the Republican Party, gerrymandered as it is, will basically prevent the courts from hearing a recount or an argument that the election was flipped?
They may, but it becomes a constitutional crisis at that point. If the Supreme Court had come back and said, yes, Florida, you must recount your votes, rather than they came back and go, okay, George, it's yours.
Right, we're good to go. Right.
If they would have come back and said that, and then Feeney would have done as he promised and said, I don't care what the vote totals say, I can send my own group of electors, there would have been an issue.
So tell me, how do you respond to someone who says, Clint, I believe you. I believe everything you say. I've seen Ian Sancho's tests. I know these machines are hackable. I know Diebold's hiding the ball. I know Florida officials are corrupt. But I don't really want to go out and vote for you because what's the point? How do you respond to someone who says that?
Because if you vote and if you register your vote, we will now have an absolute record and we will have something we can work with. You will know your vote is counted. At a minimum, you will know that your vote wasn't counted and how many votes wasn't counted, and we will be able to take these people on. So whether we are able to secure the office, and it takes 50% of the vote to win, 50% plus one. It takes 25% to run a recall.
Interesting.
So if I get the votes and they steal the office, we are already organized to the recall. We can keep them from ever taking office again.
And you can, through the Internet, protect against people voting twice and things
right.
like that.
Right. They can't vote twice. Plus, it doesn't matter. Like, you were talking about Feeney goes and he stuffs his box he reduces mine.
Right.
Another way to do it, a more confusing way, is simply for him to go in and stuff my box. So now I think I have 3,000 votes in a 300-vote district.
So that makes you look bad.
Well, it doesn't make me look bad because no one knows your vote total except for the candidate anyway. So if Feeney signs up to use the site, only he will know his vote totals. I wouldn't get to know them.
Huh.
So, but when it came down, if I thought I had 3,000 votes and I got 10,
right,
I would then contact the machine would contact the people, and if only 10 people stood up, I'd know I really only had 10 votes. Because we'll actually put it back together. We'll put the people back together with the vote.
Clint, let me ask you this. I know you used to be a Republican before all of this, and I guess the district is fairly heavily Republican.
It's conservative. It's not gerrymandered to the point that Republicans are, you know, monsters. It's 37% Republican, 34% Democrat, and the rest are independents.
Okay, so you are most famous, no question, because of this issue. It is this voting issue. That's why we spent the whole interview discussing this. What about other issues, other reasons to vote for Clint Curtis? Just before we close the interview, I want to make sure you're not a one-issue candidate. What are the other things that you are standing for in running for election?
Well, you see, I was a Republican based on the old-time Republican values of balanced budget, you know, good security.
Government out of our lives.
Good values. Exactly. Privacy.
Right.
You know, it used to be small government, don't get in my life.
Right.
Now it's I'll wiretap everything I want to see, and, you know, I'm the king. You know, bow to me. So, you know, I'm those values. And now the Democratic Party is also those values.
Checks and balances, watching over our government,
right,
making sure that there's not running amok.
And, you know, the Iraq War, basically my stance on the Iraq War is we should get out as soon as we can. I think we could get out within 90 days if we wanted to. Because we're there, we broke it, but we're there on a lie. And you cannot have we're going to stay the course if the course is a lie. You've got to fess up to the fact that, you know, you were lied to, you got there by mistake, it's time to come home. And when we come home is when that country will be able to stand up and take care of itself. Prior to that, it won't happen. Look at Vietnam. We stayed in Vietnam 25 years to stay the course.
And the irony is that only 25 years after we left, now Vietnam is coming around doing some trade deals with the United States.
And exactly. And prior to that, within 2 months of our last troops pulling out of Vietnam, the government that we built for them fell.
Right.
And the same thing has happened everywhere we've done that. The Shah of Iran.
Right.
We pulled our troops out. He fell within 2 months. So unless we plan on leaving our troops in Iraq to prop up whatever government we've built, it's going to fall, because no matter whether it is a puppet or not, it will be regarded as such.
Well, Clint Curtis, I want to wish you the best of luck for your campaign, not just for the values you talked about, but really because you, more than almost anyone else, Ian Sancho would be another hero in this regard, has brought the attention of voter security. I have never understood, and I have to tell you, I invite people on my show all the time who defend the Republican Party. Not a one of them will defend the failure of the Republicans to prevent voter fraud, and the fact that they're actually passing laws, as you point out, to protect voter fraud. This is going right on underneath the surface, and you, more than anyone else, is bringing it to our attention. Thank you very much for coming on the Inside Scoop. Before you go, though, listeners who want to help the campaign... This, I'm asking for this. How can they help you?
Website. Go to my website, www.clintcurtis.com. I need volunteers. I can take them from all over the place. We have
not just in Florida.
Not just in Florida, because we're going to do a lot of phone banking, and we can do phone banking for free, basically, from around the world. So we need that. We need money. We need to beat this guy.
ClintCurtis.com, ClintCurtis.com. Clint Curtis, thanks for coming again on the Inside Scoop.
Thank you, sir.
And I know that there are lots of you that are giving to lots of election campaigns. See if you can't help out. Just give a little bit to Clint Curtis. Heck, if not money, at least help him with his phone banks. Can you imagine having a guy like this sitting in Congress and watching over the voting issue? Boy, that would be a wonderful thing. All right, we're going to come back with the interview with Jared Bernstein, economist, talking about where the economy is going and how that will come up in the elections. Right after a little bit more, kick out the Republican music right after this.
Bush says he cares about the middle class, but the giant corporations get all the cash. We got a $500 billion deficit. It's time to make the Republicans quit.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. That special pre-election music, Kick Out the Republicans, tells us it's Election Friday. No commercials today, just Kick Out the Republicans and some really good interviews. My next interview is with Jared Bernstein, economist.
My guest right now is Jared Bernstein, who is that profession that I kind of always wanted to be but never really got there, an economist. I have a degree in economics, but that's just a bachelor's degree. This is the real deal. This is Jared Bernstein. He is with the Economic Policy Institute, and he's the author of a new book called All Together Now, Common Sense for a Fair Economy. And, Jared, I get to ask you all those tough questions that economists ask each other. It seems to me that in America that wages—it's harder for people to make a living. It just seems to me that in the 50s and the 60s you had one bread earner in the family. Today, most of the time, it's two. Is it true that economists like to throw around terms like average and median that people understand? Basically, folks, the median is what matters, not the average, because average means that if Bill Gates walks in the room, we all become richer. Median is where the middle American is.
Right.
Is the middle American, the median American, are they worse off now than they were 10, 20, 30 years ago?
Not 10, 20, 30 years ago, but interestingly, they're worse off than they were 3 or 4 years ago. Over the past couple of decades, the typical family or the median family's income is up in real terms, so maybe a 10 or 15%. But, that's far too simple a benchmark if you just look at how folks are doing relative to inflation. Are they getting ahead? Are they falling behind? If you look at the growth of, say, productivity over the past couple of decades, it's far outpaced that of the median family. And one statistic.
So in other words, when technology is increasing, everybody should be sharing in that benefit, and not everyone is.
And not everyone is, and the wedge there, the gap is that of economic inequality, which I'm sure is a topic familiar to you and your listeners. And this is the notion that as the economy has increased, technological gains have boosted productivity growth, expanded globalization has helped the economy grow more quickly. A whole set of factors have put downward pressure on the ability of the typical working family to claim their fair share of that growth. And, you know, one of the things I like to point out, and I stress this in the book, is that if you look at the period of post-war America, you look at that, say, the 20 years from the mid-40s to the mid-60s, you'll see that productivity and median family income grew in lockstep. They both doubled. If you then go from the mid-70s to now, you have productivity up about 70%, typical family income about one-third that amount. And as I mentioned, since 2000, we've had stellar productivity growth. It's really been off the charts as far as an economy.
Sure, the whole internet revolution.
Bingo.
And everything.
It's been a great few years. And if you listen to the economic cheerleaders from this town, from D.C., you'll hear that's all they're talking about. And one of the reasons is because the median family income is actually down 3%. Now, that's not gangbusters, 3%. About 50%.
But it's down.
It's down.
I mean, so in other words, you have productivity growing, gangbusters, 70%, almost doubling. Is that in 10 years or 20 years?
That's about 20 years.
In 20 years, we've almost doubled, and yet the real wages should have doubled too, right? I mean, that's the way it's supposed to work.
That's the mantra. I mean, you've studied economics. The mantra among economists, what they will teach you till they're blue in the face, is that the main determinant of living standards is productivity growth. Now, that's fine as long as inequality is not getting in between productivity growth and the living standards of the folks we're talking about here, but in fact, it's in between those two variables in a big way.
So, Jared, what's going on here? I mean, you said it yourself, 50s, 60s, 70s, pretty much we're increasing our standard of living in lockstep with productivity. Now we're getting, at best, one-third of the benefits. What's going on? What's causing that?
Well, one-third over the past a couple of decades, but over the past few years...
We're getting nothing.
Zilch. I mean...
Less than
negative.
Nothing.
Less than nothing. The main factor has to do with the reduced bargaining power, bargaining clout that most working families can claim these days. I mean, think about the job market as the mechanism by which most people are going to claim their increase in living standards. You know, there's this nonsense about we're now an investor society, but in fact, you know, most people, working families, they depend on their paycheck, not their portfolio. Sure, about half of households now hold some kind of stock, but mostly that's in their retirement funds, and wealth concentration is very much at the top of the wealth scale. Families depend on their paychecks, and so if you look at the things that have occurred in the economy, the most important things that have occurred in this regard, you have certainly the decline in unions, less collective bargaining, you have lower minimum wages, and then you have this big 800-pound gorilla, which is called globalization. Now, globalization is a very positive attribute in many ways. You know, it leads to lower prices. I'm sure everyone out there who's a consumer knows that. Probably lower interest rates. Certainly longer, less volatile business cycles. All these very positive macroeconomic kinds of things. But when you get right down to it, globalization, the way it's playing out in our economy, is eroding the bargaining power of many in the working class. And it's not just blue-collar workers. It's white-collar workers as well. And it's getting in between...
Those people that are losing those technology jobs to India. And whenever I call voicemail, I get a strange accented English that I suspect is not in Peoria.
That's one good example of what I'm talking about. But you know, you can really go all the way down the line. If you think about the way that Americans have historically bargained for their fair share of the growing economic pie, it's either through unions, it's through tight job markets, it's just basically a worker and their employer trying to hammer out a deal. But when you have a huge supply of labor, skilled labor now, by the way, who's now in the bargaining room, not necessarily with you, but over there connected by the internet, well, that's going to erode workers' bargaining.
Well, Jared, let me ask you this. I mean, there's this big debate, as you know, in Washington, D.C. over immigration, and Democrats and Republicans are split all over the map. Totally apart from the nativist issues, which I have no sympathy for, I do have sympathy for people saying, hey, all these unskilled laborers are coming across the border, and they're keeping down wages. Now, there are other people that say, hey, you know, they take jobs Americans don't want. It seems to me if you paid $20 an hour for a garbage man, people would rush to be garbage men. How do these economic things that you're talking about, is it your view that if we were to control our borders better, things would get better for the ordinary American worker?
Well, they would probably get a little bit better for the least skilled native-born worker. I mean, the research on this is pretty clear, and it's actually pretty surprising. The immigrant competition seems to lower the wages of one native group, and that's high school dropouts. Now, if you're a high school dropout in this economy, you have a whole set of problems, one of which is the fact, probably in many ways the least of which is immigrant competition. Your biggest problem is that you're a high school dropout, and that's basically the price of admission for the job market. That said, there are areas of this country where if you are a young minority native-born worker, say a young black guy in New York City, no question that immigrant competition has made your life tougher. Now, does that mean we build 500-mile walls? You know, not to me. It means we do, though, need to get control of our border and rationalize this policy. Probably the best way to go after that would be employer sanctions. Secondly, no guest worker program. The idea of a guest worker program is just exactly what you want to do if you want to have a large, entrenched, second-class citizenry embedded in your economy forever. I mean,
Jared, this is great. This is what I've been telling my listeners now for months, so it's really glad to hear it coming back at me. Folks, I did not prime him for this. He totally came at it on his own.
We're either both geniuses or we're both wrong, and I'll go with the former.
Well, let me ask you this, because in addition, obviously, to immigration, unions are weaker now probably than they've been since the 1930s. Is it because of immigration, or are there other factors at play there?
Trade is a big factor here, too. You know, we have had long, persistent imbalances in traded goods. The fact that we have lost 3 million manufacturing jobs just over the past 5 years is a part of the problem, because that's a heavily unionized sector where we have long-term trade imbalances. We import much more manufacturing goods than we export. That's hurt employment. Secondly, there's a political dimension to this. The playing field in terms of starting a union is tilted way against the unions, way against anyone who would have the gumption to actually try to form a union. The teeth that push back against illegal practices by employer who try to prevent them by firing people and undermining their efforts, that's a terribly tilted playing field. And if unions had a more level playing field, they'd do a whole lot better.
So if the Democrats were to take back Congress or take back the presidency, how would these economic factors change? I assume there'd be an increase in the minimum wage.
Oh, yeah.
Unions would be strengthened. I mean, let me ask you this. Bill Clinton, when he was president, did we see these kinds of declining real wages, or were times better for the average American worker?
Well, that's interesting. I mean, the first, basically in the early 90s, Clinton's first term, you didn't see all that much change. Starting 96 or so, Clinton did boost the minimum wage. Unions actually didn't do particularly well under Clinton, but in the latter 90s, we had the first full employment job market in 30 years, and part of that can be probably connected to Clinton's fiscal policy. It's a little dicey, and we'd probably need another 5 minutes to explore it. But there are some researchers who believe that Clinton's balanced budgets really did help boost the economy, got us to a 4% unemployment rate, had faster productivity growth, and the full employment job markets of the latter 90s really did ensure a better distribution of growth than we've had since.
One last question, and that has to do with pensions. It's my understanding, at a time when Republicans basically want to end Social Security as we know it, that you know, there was this triangle of you had Social Security and you had maybe insurance and you had pensions, but it seems to me that those are gone now. I mean, is it fair to say, and again, this is just based on my anecdotal experience, that people don't have the pensions, they don't have the retirement security today that they had 10, 20, 30 years ago?
No, that's correct, but basically the three-legged stool, as I see it, is pensions, savings, and Social Security. Now, Social Security is under attack, and unnecessarily so. It's actually, in terms of fiscal health, it's a whole lot better than a lot of other programs we ought to be a lot more worried about, like Medicare. Strengthen Social Security, and actually we have to get our pension system back on track. We've had a huge shift from defined benefit pensions, which is a guarantee, to defined contributions, which is kind of a you in the stock market sort of a scenario. Plus, with these the wage trends that we've been talking about, it's been difficult for, say, folks in the bottom half, really even the bottom three quarters, to build up enough savings. So actually, of the three-legged stool, Social Security is probably the most solid, so we have to make sure that that stays where it is. We have to strengthen the pension part of it and the savings part of it as well.
Folks, Jared has assured me that he has some time to come on for a full-hour show. We're going to try to bring him on the TV show on Mondays. One-hour show. Don't worry, we won't go for 4 hours. These are issues that really need to be explored in depth, and so I will assure you that, Jared, you'll come right back here.
Well, this
on
is a pleasure. I look forward to that.
Thank you so much for coming on.
And coming up next, my third and final interview with Democratic activist Cliff Schechter. But before I get there, one more refrain of kick out the Republicans.
Saying that the war went on because their intelligence was wrong. Was the reason for war based on lies and corruption? Where are the weapons of mass destruction?
Well, the song was from 2004, but it's even more true today. We have a chance, a real chance, to kick out the Republicans. The interview that you're going to hear next with Democratic activist Cliff Schechter, he's a political consultant. Now, remember, this interview was held 3 months ago, and I just want you to focus on how far we may have come in 3 months. And then at the end of the hour, I'm going to play the entire Kick Out the Republican song so you can hear it from beginning to end. And I want to thank the listener who sent it to me. Let's go now to my third interview with Cliff Schechter.
My guest now is Cliff Schechter. He's a writer and political consultant. He's done a lot of campaigns for the Democrats. And I'm going to question him about what we can expect for this November. Cliff, everyone is talking about that 2006 is the Democrats the way 1994 was for the Republicans. This is our chance. We're going to take back the House of Representatives, maybe even the Senate. Is this too optimistic a talk? I mean, we've got gerrymandering in Florida and Pennsylvania and Texas. We've got to win 60% of the vote just to win 50% of the vote. Do you think we're going to actually succeed here?
Well, first, thanks for having me on, Mark. Let's start with that. But I definitely think that's too optimistic talk to be going with right now. I don't think you ever want to be, you know, setting yourself up as being too optimistic. I think setting expectations low is a better idea. Look, we have to know who we're up against. I mean, just the other day, you know, when Karl Rove came out that he was not getting indicted, of course, because they don't have quite enough, immediately started going back into the old Swift boat attacks to not think that these guys are going to throw everything at us, because they know that if we are to take over the House, the Senate, there are going to be hearings and people are going to look into war profiteering, are going to look into the Valerie Plame incident, and, my God, many other things that we went on forever here. I'd be here all day listing all the things these guys have done.
Well, they've got to be really scared of that. I mean, their fingerprints are all over this kind of thing.
Of course. I mean, their fingerprints are over that, from Katrina to... So the point being is that When you know how these guys operate, when you see what just happened with the phone jamming scandal in New England, and one of the guys who was indicted said there was this culture in the GOP of where you're supposed to behave in that manner. You know, Karl Rove is part of that culture, and so are many other members of the GOP. And I can expect that besides the gerrymandering, which makes it much more difficult, states like Pennsylvania, Michigan, New York, that have had Republican governors and even some state legislatures where we should have more seats than we have, plus what they did in Texas, when you throw all that in, it's going to be difficult.
So what's the answer? Is it funneling money into the proper races? Is it getting people revved up, getting some particular leader to come through on a shining horse to lead the way? We heard Barack Obama. Maybe he's that leader. What is the answer for what Democrats need to do to get those crucial number of seats this fall?
To me, we have to absolutely speak to voters. What Barack Obama said and many other people have said at our conference here, which is so important, Democrats need to not be afraid to be Democrats. Progressives have to be proud to be progressives. The progressive vision ruled this country for 50 years before the last 20 to 30 dark years. The truth of the matter is that most people, when you talk to them, the vast majority, in fact, you get over 70% of people saying they want universal health care. You'll find the majority of people now do not want us in Iraq. We need to speak about these issues and not be scared, particularly on the issue of Iraq. We know they're going to throw the immigration issue at us and try to divide and conquer, as they always try and do. That's their populist issue to win over angry voters. We have a populist issue on our side, too, which is much more legitimate, and that's Iraq. And the truth of the matter is that we can win a lot of voters who are soft Republicans, who are independents, the people that aren't part of the cult of personality of Bush, who are upset with the GOP and realize that they've, whether they were for the war to begin with or not, they've done an absolutely horrible job in every facet, from putting too few troops in the beginning, planning along the way, to the profiteering. We need to talk about Iraq. We need to talk about getting our troops out. And if we are passionate and we stand up for what we believe in, then I believe absolutely the Senate is sort of stacked a little bit against us. That will be more difficult because the races are not in the best places. But I think then we can win back the House and at least pick up a couple seats and make the Senate close.
Well, Cliff, let me ask you about Iraq, because to some extent Democrats are still split on the issue. I think the hearts and minds of most Democrats are, this was a mistake, let's get home now. But then you see certain party leaders, like Hillary Clinton, that seem to suggest that maybe it's not all that clear. And I know there's a lot of anger in the progressive movement against people like Hillary Clinton for not saying bring the troops home now. Do you think that this split among Democrats in Iraq could harm us going into the fall?
I think potentially. One has to always remember this isn't always part of the fun storyline the mainstream media like to tell, but there's a split among Republicans, too. It's an important thing to talk about also. And in some districts, there, you know, the Chris Chases of the world and people who are in very you know, Democratic-leaning districts are going to have a very hard time explaining it. So, you know, that can hurt them also. But, yes, I think we need to speak. I wish we would speak with a more unified voice. I'm not sure what it is, you know, that these folks... This has nothing to do with being tough on security. In fact, Iraq is making us weaker now. If I can hunt down every al-Qaeda member and destroy them, I would. The problem is that they weren't in Iraq, and Iraq was a complete diversion from that. And we need to stand up and not hide from Homeland Security like we did in 2002, 2004. We need to point out these guys aren't guarding the ports. They're not fighting the war, right? They're not doing anything, right? They're not even funding New York and Washington now. They're sending money out to Topeka or wherever it is that, you know...
Wyoming's getting its share.
Exactly.
Because we all know the terrorists are going to attack Cheyenne first.
Exactly. I mean, there are a lot of horses in Cheyenne that need protecting.
Right.
Seriously, it's a joke. They're sending money where their voters are. And so the truth is that we need to point this out, stand up strong, and say, we need to be stronger in the United States. We didn't have enough National Guard to send down Louisiana during Katrina, because guess where they are? You know, they're off in Iraq. We need to be strong. What if we're attacked here? We need the guys here. We need to stand up strong. We need a unified message. And I really wish Hillary and Steny Hoyer and some of these people would understand a little bit about history and understand that whether we stay a year or 2 years or whatever after, it's not going to get any better. It's a civil war. We're not wanted there. You know, ask France about Algeria. Ask England
about the United States
India.
About Vietnam.
Yeah, I was getting there. Ask us about Vietnam. Unless, if you're an occupying force, unless the country wants you there, you eventually will leave with your tail between your legs. And we didn't do this right from the beginning. If we'd done it right and they wanted us there, it'd be a different story, but they don't.
So you think Iraq is really the biggest issue for the fall, bigger than oil prices or, Katrina or healthcare or anything like that?
I absolutely do. I think it's a huge issue. It's an overarching issue because I think it brings together many of the other issues that we want to talk about. The money being spent in Iraq right now is money that's not being spent on Homeland Security, that's not being spent on healthcare for veterans, not being spent on healthcare just for Americans here at home. In addition to that, the corruption that's going on with the war profiteering ties very nicely to the corruption of these guys, you know, who like to have nice poker parties at the Watergate.
But see, part of my fear about this corruption is because the Republicans are the party of bribery. They're the party where they're getting millions and billions of dollars and of course, you know, paying it out in millions and billions of taxpayer dollars. They got more money than we do. They can finance their campaigns more than we do. They always go into every single election far more funded than we are. How do we counteract that?
Well, first of all, that's always difficult, and the truth is that if it were always just based upon money, we would never win, right? Except for the occasional John Corzine.
That's the exception.
I mean, you know, but otherwise we wouldn't be able to win ever. That's first of all, the power of our ideas wins out there.
Do we have enough money though to compete in all those districts that are close enough for us to actually take the House?
I certainly believe so. I just saw an article that came out in the Washington Post the other day that said that we were catching up in the fundraising. The DSCC is actually outraised its counterpart on the Republican side, so they're doing great. On the congressional side, we haven't done quite as well, but what I was reading, we were catching up. So I do really think that we're going to do well. And then, thankfully, you know, it's a sad thing, in my opinion, that democracy has to be this way. But because of the system we're under, and because of the way the laws are, and you can spend as much money as you want, you know, we do have some people that have some money that they can spend running, too.
The recent election of Brian Bilbray in San Diego is an election that... It depressed me a little. Some Democrats saw a lot of hope because here you have a 60% Republican district and he only wins, you know, 52-48%. But, you know, it was gerrymandered like so many districts across the country. He did win in a district where Duke Cunningham is, you know, in jail for bribery. If we
with
can't
his
win,
commode.
Yeah, right. I don't know if they let him have that in the prison, but you know, if we can't win in Brian Bilbray's seat, what does this say? I mean, should we be concerned about that?
Well, I'd be concerned, and you know, that leads me back to, I guess, where I went with Iraq here, which is my critique of that race would be that, you know, we talked about the culture of corruption, but didn't tie it into greater themes. And so our candidate talked about it, you know, but Bilbray, particularly in a district that's right on the border in San Diego, was able to use the immigration issue to their advantage. I believe that our candidate talked more about Iraq, had talked, you know, and stood up instead of, from what I understand, not talking about it at all. I think we would have had a much better chance of taking that seat.
What should be the Democratic position on immigration, in your view?
I mean, that's a tough one. You know, the Democratic position, I think, first of all, I think that you know, right away. I don't want to throw out that we should just throw together a petition, you know, without putting a lot of thought into it. You know, let's say what we shouldn't be for. The thought that you're going to put up a wall, you know, build this big fence, and that's going to stop people from coming in, I think is silly. And history once again would show that wouldn't work. You know, just ask the Chinese with Genghis Khan. That's not going to work. But I think that we need to come up with a more progressive vision and understand that we are the party that are taking care of people. We're not just worrying about, you know, when President Bush comes out with his vision on immigration, you know, it's making sure there are workers there for corporations. We need to come out and worry about the fact that there's a livable wage. We need to talk about the fact that certain free trade deals, NAFTA among them, has really lowered the bar and lowered wages in Mexico. We need to do something to build up the wages so we don't have people that need to run across the border because they can't find jobs in their own country. So many of the issues have an economic underpinning, and we try to just pretend we're going to put up a wall and aim some guns at you, and that's going to stop it. And that's not it. I think we need to tackle the economic problems. And I know it's more complex than that, and I'm not saying it's not. We have to be careful at times not to reward people and say you're just going to come here and immediately you're going to become a citizen. And I'm not for that either. But certainly, I think if you attack the economic side first, you'll get a lot further.
My solution has always been if you sanction the employers, that would cut off a lot of demand for this kind of labor.
That's another actually very intelligent plan.
So let's do it to a bottom line. Going to give me a prediction for this fall? How many seats are we going to pick up?
My prediction is I do think we're going to take the House back. I think
we'll get the 15 seats we need.
I do. I don't think we're going to win overwhelmingly, but I do think...
That's enough. That would be a huge landslide. If just taking back the House, allowing for subpoena power, allowing for us to investigate some of these things the Bush administration is doing, that would be a landslide in itself, even if we just get 16.
No, you're absolutely right. In terms of what it would allow us to do, which is actually to get involved in this quaint notion, I think it's called oversight. Congress once did
checks
it.
And balances. I think
right.
The founders talked about something like that.
In the Federalist
Papers, that was before the Bush dictatorship, I think, back in the last millennium.
That's it, exactly.
Right.
When they believe in that kind of thing. So, yes, I mean, in that way, it would be a landslide. I do think we have that because there's so many seats that they didn't think were going to be vulnerable that are. I mean, we're looking at seats that are unbelievable that, you know, that are winnable for Democrats. The Democrats stick and, you know, yes, talk about the culture of corruption that pervades the Republican Party in Washington, but talk about Iraq and what they've done. Talk about health care, you know, and now don't just say we want to give a few more people health care. Talk about really broadening health care to cover everybody. You know, have courage, be progressive. I think we'll do that. On the Senate side, I think it's tougher. I mean, we draw a royal flush. I think we have a shot at taking the Senate back. I would lower my expectations.
3-4 seats?
Yeah. I think 3-4 seats.
And we need 6.
Yes, we need 6 or 5 to tie. I see us.
Of course, the tie doesn't help us any with Cheney.
Right, exactly. Yeah, so. That definitely doesn't. I see us coming up probably a little short of that, maybe picking up, I think, 3 or 4 seats.
Well, one thing I'm sure of is that my favorite person to hate in the Senate, Rick Santorum, is going down. And that in itself will be reason to praise the voters on November.
Champagne should be coming out just for that reason, that he can go and tell his stories about people and dogs somewhere else.
Somewhere else. Cliff Schechter, thank you for coming here on the Insights.
Thank you so much, Mark. I appreciate it.
So you heard it. That's the third interview. Now, of course, that interview was done pre the Mark Foley scandal. And what's interesting, of course, is that Cliff Schechter felt, as I did, that we could take back the House even before the scandal. Now I think we need to go for more. It's important that we not win the House by 218, 219, 220 votes, which would allow a few conservative Democrats to actually make the difference in the race. We've got to win not just by a Democratic majority, but by a progressive majority. So, folks, if you have not yet gone out, bought a yard sign, gone to your local phone bank, contributed what money you can to your local Democratic Party, what's keeping you? This election, more than any other, could make the difference. You know what they say? I mean, I know we say that every election, but in this election, it matters whether the Democrats win 220 in the House or 235 in the House. And what's happening now is you have about 40 or 50 seats that are suddenly competitive. Now, that's very rare in the House of Representatives. The way the House of Representatives works is it's so gerrymandered. The district lines are drawn so carefully that rarely do more than 15 or 20 incumbents even risk not winning their reelection. But this election is different. This election, many of the Republicans are staying home unless they you know, cheat, which is another concern of mine. Certainly, I expect the Republican turnout to be way down. And so we can reach deep. We can win those seats that, we really didn't think we could win just a few months ago when I did this interview with Cliff Schechter. Even the Senate is in play. Now, I will admit, that's an uphill battle. In fact, if the election were held today, I think we would end up with a 50-50 Senate and Cheney breaking the tie. And that, my friends, isn't good enough. We've got to hold on to New Jersey. Folks, if you're in New Jersey, I'm not a big fan of Bob Menendez, but we need his vote. We need his vote to get a majority in the Senate. He's certainly a better man than Tom Keene. And then in Missouri, a very, very important race. I think we can win Missouri. I think we can hold New Jersey. And then it just comes down to one of two states. My home state of Tennessee, or the state right across the border in Virginia, those are the states to win. And Harold Ford is neck and neck with Bob Corker, and Jim Webb is in neck and neck with George Allen. I particularly want to see Webb win in Virginia, given that Allen is awful. I mean, he's a racist. He's an idiot. I mean, it's not just that he's a racist. He's also an idiot, and he's also someone who will do whatever George Bush says. He's not a man who thinks on his feet. He is, you know, for all we talk about Republicans, and I can complain about John McCain like the rest of them, but then there are some Republicans that are so awful, so idiotic, so will do whatever the corporations ask them to do, and that's Senator George Allen. So if you can help Jim Webb in Virginia, you need to do that. But like I said, even if we don't win the Senate, just watching Rick Santorum get kicked out of office will be a good day for me. So I know there's a lot of pessimism out there just because we've been defeated so many times. Work with me. Just one more election. 3 more weeks. Work your heart out. Go to your phone banks. Go on election day. Make sure that people's votes are not stolen. Make sure that people – this is what I do, by the way, every election day. And you don't have to be a lawyer to do it. It helps if you are a lawyer. But you don't have to be. Just go there. And if you see someone turned away because their name isn't on the voting rolls, you remind that voter and the election official that this person has an absolute right to cast a provisional ballot, those little green forms, and go let that person cast a provisional ballot. It could well be the difference. You know, it's interesting to me in Cliff Schechter's interview that he thought Iraq would be the biggest issue. And at the end of the day, I still think it is. Mark Foley's fun to discuss. We'll be talking more about it. If you've looked at my website, you'll see Foley's last IM, his last instant message. It's shocking, folks. And more evidence is coming out. Jeff Trandall, the clerk, who I know just testified today, and everyone's backing him up. There's no question that the leadership knew, that Hastert knew, that Boehner knew. So this is something to depress the Republican vote, and it will. I think Christian conservatives, frankly, are shocked to find out that there are gay Republicans at all. But for the rest of us, we don't have to look at Foley. We don't have to look at all the other pages. By the way, there are other pages, apparently, that Republicans have been fiddling with. I think that will come out before the election. We need, I think, just to focus on the war in Iraq, an elective war, a war we didn't need to fight, a war that has made America and the world less safe. And that's more than enough reason to vote for the Democratic Party in November and to encourage all your friends and family to do so. That's it for the Inside Scoop. I'm going to play at the end the entire Kick Out the Republican song so you can enjoy as much as I do. Tune in next week. In addition to the Week in Review, I have a terrific debate on the issue of whether or not gay people should be allowed to marry too, relating to Virginia's measure on the ballot. You won't want to miss that. That's Monday night and also Tuesday right here on the Horn. But for now, let's play Kick Out the Republicans.
counted the votes in a web of deception. The GOP stole the election. It's a good thing that Saddam was captured, hiding in a hole just like a rat would. Now they're saying that the war went on because their intelligence was wrong. Was the reason for war based on lies and corruption? Where are the weapons of mass destruction?
Network.
Welcome to the Guy James Show, everybody. Glad to have you along with us this afternoon. Lots to talk about today, as always. It seems like it's been forever since I was last sitting here in front of the microphone, and it's only been a few days, but my goodness, we're back with you, and glad to be so. We've got a lot to talk about today. Hope we can get it all in. If we don't, we'll do it tomorrow. Okay. Let's make a date for tomorrow, same time, same station, right here on the Head On Radio Network. Glad to have you with us today on the Head On Radio Network. Bob Kincaid's going to be following up today. I'll be on until 6 o'clock today. Bob and I are splitting Bruce's on a little bit of a hiatus, and Bob and I are splitting his shift, so I will be here till 6. All right. Quit your griping. I heard you, all you Bruce fans. Put up with me, okay? Hey, we're going to try and have an interesting show with you today, for you today. We've got Bo Grosskopf coming up a little later. He's a professor out at the University of California, and we're going to talk about that death toll in Iraq that the right-wingers just don't want to accept. And congratulations to our good friend Mike Malloy. It looks to me like Mike is employed again, and going to be taking off, what, I blasted off on the 30th of the month. Don't know a lot of the details about it yet, but that's a good thing. And we're all celebrating today. There are 300 million of us now here in the country. And don't you know, they had to throw that in on the news that the 300 millionth one was probably Hispanic. Ah, yeah, they just had to get that in there. Taking a look around at some of the news, I see the polls now have dropped down to 34% in favor of the Bush war. 34%, two-thirds of the people of the United States don't want us to be in Iraq. And some more good news. You know how well everything's going over in Iraq right now. They keep saying, you know, making a lot of progress. I see they fired 3,000 of their cops today. And you know why. They're suspected of being in on those death squads and everything else. Things just aren't going so well. And something I hope to maybe talk about a little later on in today, one of our listeners sent me an email about this, and I'm afraid it jarred me a little bit to listen to it. I try and keep up on everything, but it brought me back to a realization that there's something that's strangely amiss in the political discourse nowadays between the right and the left. The candidates in particular, not us. We talk about it all the time. But have you noticed that the candidates are not talking about the war? They're not debating the war. And we'll get into that hopefully a little later on today. What else have we got here scheduled for today? Oh, I see Fred Barnes. I don't know why I subject myself to this sort of thing, but Fred Barnes, well, I didn't. Somebody sent it to me. Okay, I'm not guilty. I didn't watch Fox. Fred Barnes, I can't stand Fred Barnes, long before he was ever with Fox News. He wrote that in his latest column that Nancy Pelosi is the most unpopular national politician in America. There you go again. Fox people making their own news. Doesn't matter if it's true or not. They make up their own news. They said Nancy Pelosi's the most unpopular national politician in America, which it totally ignored recent opinion polls showing that the President Bush, his vice president, his defense secretary, and the Republican leaders of both houses of Congress are far less popular than Pelosi. But, you know, he's on Fox. So, you know how that goes. And while we're on that subject, just for a moment, humor me for a moment. While we're on that subject,